This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 66th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Sherry Lawrence Flieger. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Sherry Lawrence Flieger is the Director of Research for the Institute for Information Infrastructure Protection at Dartmouth. From 2002 to 2010, Dr. Flieger was a senior researcher at RAND Corporation, where she worked on policy and decision-making around IT. From 1982 to 2002, Sherry was president of the consulting firm Systems Software, Inc., and a visiting computer science professor at University of Maryland. Dr. Flieger began her career as a developer. She has since published many books, including Software Metrics, Solid Software, Security in Computing, and Software Engineering. Dr. Flieger holds a PhD from George Mason University, an MS from Penn State, and also an MA, and a BA in math from Harper College. She lives with the other Dr. Flieger in the Washington, D.C. area. So thanks for joining us today, Sherry.
Oh, thanks for doing your homework. That was quite a summary of my career.
Well, let's see if I get some questions that are pretty good. The first one's really easy. What is the difference between safety-critical software and security-critical software?
Okay. I'll use an example that that I've heard other people use. I think this actually comes from Nancy Levison, which is you could take a bomb, for instance, and have it sit at the bottom of the ocean, and it might be secure because nobody can get at it, but it might not be safe because it could still explode. So safety is really has to do more with protecting people, and security has more to do with the ability to get inside something and change it.
So wouldn't you say that most safety critical software better be secure, or else it has a safety problem in the form
absolutely.
Of attackers?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I don't want to wade too much into this, because there's an ongoing debate between the safety people and the security people about the difference. But I think in general, quality is good. We need to think about both of those things, and they can, in fact, impinge on each other.
Always the peacemaker you are. So do the techniques that you addressed in the book you wrote with Les Hatton back in 2001 inform security and building secure systems?
Only somewhat. When we wrote that book, and we had a third author, Chuck Howell, who's still at MITRE.
Oh, I forgot Chuck.
Sorry. That's okay. So we sat around, the three of us, and we said, you know, if we could do a few things now that we already know how to do to make our software better, what would those things be? And so that's where the chapters from the book came from. And so we weren't thinking specifically about security. We were just thinking about, how can we pull up our socks and do things better right now with techniques we already know?
Mm-hmm. And Les has always been very practical that way in his work, I think.
Right.
So I'm interested in the notion of intention and the intention of an attacker, which in my view really informs security a lot. That is, you know, you can protect against random sunspot activity, but it's much harder to protect against informed adversary who's going after your system. So how does intention like that impact security, and what can we do to model that or to think about that while we're building stuff?
Well, I'm not a social scientist, but I actually look at some of those things to try to inform the way I do security. You've hit on what I think is the soft underbelly of security, that no matter how much we harden the technology, we still have people thinking about other ways to get inside our systems or do things to our systems. For one thing, we have to live with the uncertainty. No matter how many fingers we put in the dike, to mix lots of metaphors here, We're still, the adversary is still going to be thinking about other ways that perhaps we haven't thought of.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason why I would really like to get around the table some criminologists and some security people, because people have been committing crimes for a long time.
Exactly.
And in some ways, security is just another one of them. And so learning from the criminologists how they think about the criminals and how to approach the criminals could give us some strategies for understanding how intention works.
I think that's a great idea. You know, I've always been struck by the fact that if you go way back in newspapers, back in the yellow aging newspapers or the microfilm files, you can find these newspaper stories from the 1800s when telephones were first being introduced that say things like telephone crime.
Well, and in fact,
and they strike me a lot like the same stories today. Internet crime.
Well, and in fact, in today's Washington Post, this is a very timely phone call, there's an article in the style section by Monica Hess, who writes about social networking. And she says essentially what you just said. She says all this stuff about Twitter and MySpace and Facebook are interesting, but it's not really about the technology. It's about the things people are doing. And she ends the column with some alarmist statements that were actually made about the telephone.
Yeah, very nice. Cool.
Yeah.
I love it. I usually read the Post, but I haven't read today's paper yet. It's sitting in my car. So
it will still be there when you get to the
car. It will, well, hopefully. So now a little bit of controversy. Software engineering can be incredibly dull.
Yes.
So do you think that security is a reasonable way to punch up software engineering and make it appeal?
So let me answer your question with a question. A lot of the software we use today is not written by people with software engineering training.
Right.
So when you say appeal to whom? How are we going to, even if we have techniques we know work already, how do we get the right people to use them and to want to use them?
I have an answer for that. So appeal to students in particular.
Okay.
I once gave a talk at a software engineering conference about security, and I suggested that some of the academics, there are about 200 or so in the audience, try putting some security stuff in the announcement of their class. And the people who tried that reported back later and said, you know, that's the first time I've had my class oversubscribed in years, and the kids really loved it. And the great thing was they were learning stuff that you and I know is very important about testing, about, you know, quality and reliability and other aspects of just making software behave, which, if couched in the right way, might be more appealing to youngsters.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to make it more appealing using security, but I don't think that's the only way to do it. I think sometimes we underestimate students because we give them really boring problems to try to solve with their software.
Uh-huh.
So one of the best classes I ever had was trying to get students to stop thinking about code and start thinking about the everything else, especially the importance of requirements. So I had my parents travel down from New York to the University of Maryland, where I was teaching this class, and they were the customers, and my students had to interview them. Now, when I was a kid, this will tell your audience how old I am, my father had a gas station, and every month, at the end of the month, my sister, my mother, my father, and I would sit around the table with little pieces of paper that were receipts from my father's ongoing clients, and we would sort them, and we would staple the ones together that belonged to a single client. My mother would take an adding machine and add up all the totals, and my father would send out the bills.
Mm-hmm.
So the class at the University of Maryland was about how to automate that system.
Right.
So
real-world example was the key.
Real-world example. Yeah. And, of course, the students came up with a million-dollar system that could do it, and we had to remind them that a gas station is not a $1 million business. And it was really interesting for the students and, of course, for my parents, because it introduced them to the realities of systems. It also introduced them to the realities of clients, that not every client talks the jargon of the students and the software engineers.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's a great video online from the BBC. If you put in a search engine, One Ronnie Blackberry. You can find it. One Ronnie refers to the comedians.
We'll put a link to that on the website.
And it's about a guy who walks into a fruit and vegetable stand asking for help with his blackberry. And it's a hoot. And it's all about how we use jargon in many ways to keep each other out instead of to bring each other together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you brought up the idea of requirements and thinking about the big picture in the system, because I think there's a lot that software engineering has in it which has been borrowed for software security, which is certainly not only about just looking at code. In fact, architecture analysis plays just as important of a role there as code review. And there are plenty of other things that we can learn from software engineering. And so my view is that everything in basic software engineering, basic blocking and tackling stuff, is useful for software security. But I wonder if you agree with that.
Well, I think you're right. But I think we need to be careful to focus on a handful of really key skills that make good software engineers and also make good security engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them are modeling and design. And we don't do a good job of teaching modeling and design. I once said that at a conference, and a professor, a very brave professor, stood up and said, "Well, I don't know how to do modeling and design. That's why I teach my students how to program."
Right.
Instead.
Well, that's so true. And
But the whole notion of abstraction and understanding the key elements of a problem are not things we're good at teaching people, but you need those both for security and for software engineering. And you need to understand which things change and which things stay the same over time.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think there are a lot of people in other engineering disciplines that take a slightly more, I don't know, real world or cynical approach to the universe in their pedagogy. For example, when you take mechanical engineering, the first thing they do is show you Petrosky's book or maybe the Tacoma's Narrow Bridge video of the thing shaking itself to death.
Right.
But the first thing that you get in computer science class is, okay, everybody write hello world.
Right. Followed by the elevator problem.
And so nobody explains to you, by the way, if you write bad code, it could kill people and shake the bridge to death or whatever. And I think a little bit of that might help.
Well, we're actually trying to fix that a little bit on a project I've been doing with NIST, and now I've just gotten some funding from DHS to do this a little bit more of the same thing, which is to develop some case studies, to look at good examples in this particular instance of how people combine usability, security, and software engineering.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try to interview a bunch of people and see what they really do, see what some of the risks are, and try to capture the things that make them good at developing usable security as part of their ordinary software engineering. But that kind of case study approach, which is used in law schools, which is used in some medical schools, might be a way for us to make security and software engineering more interesting and more relevant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So way back in 1998, you wrote the book Software Metrics.
Right.
Then just last year in 2010, you published this paper called Why Measuring Security is Hard.
Right.
So why is measuring software security or software security metrics hard?
Oh, well, there are lots of reasons. And I guess you asked two questions rolled up in one.
Sneaky.
Measuring things in general is hard. For a lot of reasons, one of which is people are already overbooked. They have too many things to do before the software is ready to be shipped. So asking them to do yet another thing is very hard. Asking them to do a thing that can help them meet their budget and schedule is something they might welcome, though. So to answer the second part of your question about why software metrics are hard, sometimes it's because we ask them for too much, much of which is not useful.
Mm-hmm.
So measuring useful things that can help them save time and improve quality might be welcomed. And that's been my experience. Ask for a small number of things that have clear utility. Software measuring security is hard because it's different. Things change. Composition doesn't work the way it does in other things. You can't take two secure pieces, compose them, and know that you've got a secure result. And the article lays out, I think we had nine different reasons why it's hard. Not the least of which has to do with the way people perceive security and risk and likelihood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or misperceive, as the case
may be. Or misperceive it. And it's not that they're boneheads. It's that we're all wired that way. We're all wired, when the impact is high and the probability is small, to focus on the impact, even though the probability is small.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Otherwise, people would never play the lottery.
Well, you know what I've seen in my experience is a lot of geeks that like to measure direct software characteristics that are easy to measure, like bugs per square inch, for example.
Right, right.
But may only tangentially inform the property of security. And so, in fact, in my work, I've had to retreat somewhat distressingly to talking about process and activities. You know, the BSIM model is about mm-hmm. activities. And gosh, if you'd have told me 10 years ago that I wouldn't be mucking around with code, but I would rather be talking about processes that people use to write better code, I think I would have run away screaming. But it may be a necessary move. I think it may be. What do you?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, the answer to every question is it depends, and this question is the same. I think doing only process can be dangerous, because then you're just checking boxes.
Right.
But doing process that's clearly linked to outcomes, it's like measuring health. There's nothing particular that you measure about health, but there are characteristics that suggest that you're healthy or not healthy, or that your health is changing.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to link the process measures to the outcome measures so that you can see when changes in process lead to different outcomes. If changes in process don't lead to different outcomes, then measuring the process is silly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So another topic altogether. Where do good software security people come from, and how can we make more?
This is actually more controversial than you're letting on, I think, because, as you know, there's an argument about how maybe we shouldn't have people who are schooled only in security. Maybe we should take people who are good at the other things we want them to do and make them more aware of security or add security to their tools.
Oh, I totally believe that. It's too impossible to teach security people about all the ins and outs of building real software.
Well, and just as I said, the video that I mentioned, the BBC video, shows how we use jargon to separate us.
Mm-hmm.
That is true in spades with security people. And so where do they come from? I think they come from people who are already building software, and we teach them how, or enable them to include security in the things that they think about when they write requirements, do designs, do their tests.
So that answer seems right to me, but how do you teach security to anybody, much less those people?
Well, it goes back to something you said earlier in the conversation about how we use toy examples for software engineers and they don't realize that this software can kill people. I think raising awareness of consequences goes a long way to getting people who are already writing software interested in making sure their software is secure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
After all, a lot of them take pride in their products, and they are usually quite surprised when their products don't work the way they had intended them to work. So security is just another example of how they need to broaden their perspective and make sure that that the code that they write and test and field is secure.
Mm-hmm. So another topic. Technology transfer is pretty difficult, and it takes decades. For example, it took us about 10 years to get static analysis for security for software code from the lab to the real world through DARPA, the ATP, Kleiner, and finally HP. And that 10 years is a long time. What, in your view, is the most important thing you've learned about tech transfer and how to do tech transfer?
Well, I guess I've learned a couple of things. One is you don't want to do it too fast, because sometimes the technologies that sound very promising today, in a month's time, just don't seem exactly right anymore. So a bit of empirical evidence is always helpful before you go out and proselytize.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I don't think there's much way of getting around the fact that software developers love tools and toys. So one way to speed up technology transfer is to embed it in something that the developers can use as a tool or a toy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not always the case, but it's frequently the case. And even if it's a little bit less effective by embedding it in a tool, getting it used is better than having it sit on a shelf.
Right. So what do you think about this time notion that I sort of stated? Does a decade seem like the right kind of time frame in your experience? That's what it looks like to me.
Oh, I think it varies. I think it varies a lot. I think, I think, for instance, Fagan wrote his first paper on code reviews in 1976,
and there
are still lots and lots of development organizations that don't really do effective code reviews if they do them at all.
That's right.
So, but there's an example of something that's hard to automate.
Right. So we automated parts of that for security, looking for particular bugs.
Right. And so in cases like that, you have to ask yourself, okay, if I can't do it everywhere and I can't do it with everybody, where can I do it strategically to get people to want to do this? You know, where can they see the rewards pretty quickly, and then they go out and they tell their friends how great it is and they should do it too.
Right.
And so you might target the most dangerous parts of a system and do the code reviews on that. The same is true with formal methods,
mm-hmm.
And with requirements techniques. I once worked with an organization that knew it was terrible at gathering requirements, but it also knew it had lots of geeks, and so they ended up buying a requirements tool. I don't think it was really the tool that helped them, but the awareness about the importance of requirements was sort of embedded in the tool. So it wasn't the best solution, but at least it moved people forward into paying more attention to requirements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Practicality again. So you founded the ACM Committee for Women and Minorities.
Right.
Why are there so few women in computing, and what can we do about that?
Oh, I wish I knew the answer to that. The number of women graduating with CS degrees peaked, let me say the percentage of women out of the total number of CS graduates peaked in about 1992, and it's been dropping steadily ever since, and nobody seems to know why. I've talked to people not just in the U.S., but all over the place, and everybody's scratching their heads. It's not really clear what's happening. It could be that a lot of women are turned on to CS, but they go into the place it's applied, so they go into bioengineering instead of into CS.
Mm-hmm. Or informatics or something like that.
Right. So I don't really know the answer. I wish I did. I do see a lot more women at conferences. I see a lot more women when I visit development organizations. They're taken more seriously. But we still have a problem, and I don't really know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm. So, lastly, I greatly admire your community service and philanthropy, and I'm wondering if you can give some advice to Silver Bullet listeners about how to give back to their communities, maybe based on your own experience or just maybe some general advice.
Oh, well, thanks. That's a part of me most people don't know about. I would not have gotten to where I am now if it hadn't been for other people giving me good advice, giving me opportunities. And so I just think, you know, the best thing I can do is turn around and do that for other people. So everybody has different ways of giving back, different preferences. But, for the listeners or the readers, you know, think about what people have done for you and what you would enjoy turning around and doing for them. It could be anything from teaching an adult to read, teaching a kid to read, funding a scholarship, doing volunteer work. It's whatever your comfort level is, but it's got to be something you really like doing, because otherwise you won't do it for very long. Certainly the professional organizations like the ACM and the IEEE have lots and lots of opportunities. So as a start, you can always scrutinize those and see if there's a way to give back through the professional organizations.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, and thanks again for your own service. I think it's awesome. One last crazy question. So what is your favorite fiction book that you've read recently?
That I've read recently?
Yep.
Probably The Hours by Michael Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the most perfect book I've ever read.
Wow.
There's not a single word in that book that doesn't belong, and there's nothing missing in that book. I would read that again and again, and that's not something I say about most books.
Interesting. Well, thanks for your time, Sherry. It's been great.
Thanks a lot.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P features an article on trustworthy computing, as well as an interview with John Savage. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.